Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 907, update on Ukraine. This is being recorded on May 15th of the year 2016. Well, obviously, as the title indicates, this is bringing up to date a number of developments vis-a-vis our investigation of the Ukrainian crisis that we have not covered before. In particular, we're going to be taking a look at some of the historical background and deep politics surrounding what is now unfolding in Ukraine in order to understand not only the depth, the historical and political depth, really the deep politics and the history of Ukrainian fascism, and also to understand how that is being distorted. It would be, I think, impossible to exaggerate the extent to which we are now living in an absolutely catastrophic time in a number of ways, quite apart from environmental factors such as climate change / global warming, and quite apart from the perilous financial dynamics that may very easily plunge the world into yet another economic / financial crisis. The events that are now manifesting in Ukraine and around the Earth Island in general may very well lead to a third world war. In particular, the installation by the West, chiefly the U.S. and Germany, of a World War II-era fascist organization, the OUNB, as the primary element in a, quote, nationalist, unquote, government in Ukraine, and the simultaneous installation of military units and the anti-missile systems very close to Russia's border is, frankly, something that is a rolling of the dice. And it is to be hoped that Russian leadership is a whole lot more intelligent and circumspect than our leadership, because otherwise I'm afraid there is going to be a third world war. In For the Record programs 884, 885, and 886, we took a look at my analysis of what I call the Earth Island boogie of the Earth Island, that stretch of land going from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way across Europe, Asia, Russia, and most of the Middle East, China, and India. Is one giant block of land controlling or containing most of the world's landmass, natural resources, and the population. Controlling that has long been seen as a key to world domination. And what we looked at in our various programs about the Earth Island boogie concerns the installation of fascist governments of one kind or another, from the Islamic fascist government in Turkey under Erdogan, by the way, a NATO member, to the OUNB Ukrainian fascists who dominate the government in Ukraine, one that supposedly shares our values, to the Hindu nationalist / fascist government of Narendra Modi, whose BJP party is frankly just a political cat's paw for the RSS, again, a Hindu nationalist and fascist organization, one of whose alumni assassinated Mahatma Gandhi. We are looking at the installation of fascist governments all around Russia and China, and the use of Islamists and pan-Turkist elements as proxy warriors against Russia and China. ISIS and the bombings in Europe and shootings in the U.S. are yet another example of blowback from those actions. So was apparently the Boston Marathon bombing as well. One of the things that we have looked at is, and something we're going to explore today, is the role of the Ukrainian diaspora in the U.S., in particular, in the perpetuation of Ukrainian fascism in partnership with German fascism its collaboration with U.S. intelligence, its installation at the core of the Republican Party under the Crusade for Freedom, its maturation into a key element of foreign policy under the Reagan administration. Recall that the CFF was both a foreign covert operation which perpetuated guerrilla warfare in the Baltic states and Eastern Europe using various Third Reich ally combatants such as the UPA in Ukraine as proxy warriors, that being done by the OPC and CIA. At the same time, many of these Eastern European fascist collaborators were installed as political leaders in various Eastern European ethnic voting blocs in the U.S. That led to the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization, literally a Nazi branch of the Republican Party with its roots firmly anchored in the soil of the Third Reich. The head of that project was Alan Dulles. It was overseen by his protege, Richard Nixon. It was fronted for by the chief spokesperson, that was Ronald Reagan. The State Department machinations to bring these people into the country were handled by William Casey. And the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization was installed as a permanent branch of the Republican Party under Richard Nixon by George H.W. Bush, then the head of the Republican National Committee. When Reagan came to power, we had Reagan, we had William Casey as first his campaign manager and then his CIA director, we had George H.W. Bush as his vice president, and many of Reagan's early appointees, such as Caspar Weinberger, George Shultz, and Alexander Haig, and Richard Allen, his first national security advisor, were all veterans of the Nixon administration. So basically, what we had under Reagan was the fulfillment of the Crusade for Freedom, and the OUNB from Ukraine was at the center of that. Reagan's deputy director of public liaison was a woman named Ekaterina Tymoshenko, a key member of the top OUNB front in the U.S., the UCCA, the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America. Under the Free Congress Foundation's liberation program, many of these same OUNB and other Eastern European fascist organizations and individuals were projected back into the former Soviet Union. The head of the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization, Arrow Cross veteran Laszlo Pastor, was also the head of the Free Congress Foundation's Liberation Committee. After the breakup of the former Soviet Union, we saw in 2004 the so-called Orange Revolution. Viktor Yushchenko, the head who came to power through that, had as his first lady the former Ekaterina Tymoshenko. That was the person who was Reagan's deputy director of public liaison. The Minister of Justice under Yushchenko was a guy named Roman Zvorich. And Zvorich was the head, or rather the personal secretary, to Yaroslav Stetsko, who was the wartime figurehead, basically the wartime nominal head of state in Ukraine, and collaborated with the Third Reich and implemented Third Reich-style ethnic cleansing operations in Ukraine, both against Jews, Russians, and Poles as well. And again, Roman Zvorich was the equivalent of Attorney General under Viktor Yushchenko. One of the things that we looked at in For the Record 781 was how when Yushchenko came to power, he installed a guy named Volodymyr Vyatrovich as the head of the Institute of National Memory and also as the head of the archives or controller of the archives of the SBU, the Ukrainian Intelligence Service, and the successor to the KGB. What Vyatrovich did was to collaborate with another OUNB guy named Nalavichenko, who was the head of the SBU, to basically whitewash Ukraine's World War II history. Eventually, Viktor Yushchenko, who proved to be massively corrupt, was voted out of office, although he did his best to institutionalize the heritage of the OUNB And Viatrovich was removed from office. However, when the Maidan or Maidan coup took place, Valentin Nalavichenko, an OUNB operative associated with Pravi sector, became the head of Ukrainian intelligence, and Volodymyr Viatrovich once again was appointed as the head of the Institute of National Memory. And what we're going to look at is something we have looked at before, although now it comes from a more mainstream source. This one, however, is also inclined to a bit of revisionism. What's interesting in the tone of this article, which comes from Foreign Policy Magazine, that is put out by the Council on Foreign Relations, about as mainstream as you're going to be, is the way that it approaches this unabashed Nazi revisionism, a very tenuous approach to it. It says this lends credence to the Russian charge that the Ukrainian government is dominated by fascists and Nazis. It bloody well is, and there could be no clearer example of this. That's not to say that everyone in the government is a Nazi per se. There's certainly the dissatisfaction of the Ukrainian people with the state of governance for many, many years, including the Yanukovych government, certainly is grounded in some very realistic grievances. However, the government now dominating Ukraine could not realistically be tabbed as anything but Nazi or fascist. Even the ones who aren't Nazis or fascists are people who are actively collaborating with those individuals. I would note that the current president of Ukraine, Petro Poroshenko, laid a wreath in tribute to the OUNB at Babi Yar, the scene of one of the leading massacres of the Holocaust. And that massacre basically was implemented in large measure by members of the OUNB. And again, that, I think, speaks volumes for the degree of collaboration of Viktor Petro Poroshenko. I would note that the recent replacement of Yatsenyuk as the prime minister of Ukraine and his replacement by a Jew is, and this is something we will have in the written description for this program, was much celebrated, but what was not noted was that the new prime minister has a law degree from the MOP University in Ukraine. That is the epicenter of most of the anti-Semitic literature and ideology being disseminated in Ukraine. To give you an idea of what MOP University is all about, one of its faculty members, I should say, was David Duke. So about the Orwellian rewriting of Ukrainian history, from Foreign Policy Magazine of May 2nd of 2016. It's an article by Josh Cohen, C-O-H-E-N. The historian whitewashing Ukraine's past, unquote. And there are a number of things to note in this. First of all, note that after Viktor Yushchenko was voted out of office, Volodymyr Viatrovich, the head of the Institute for National Memory, came back to the U.S., where he basically operated in between the Yushchenko and Maidan or Maidan governments. Then, once the Maidan coup took place, he came back to Ukraine and was reinstalled in his position by Poroshenko. I would also note that the Ukrainian Minister of Education, a guy named Sergei Kvit, K-V-I-T, is a bird of the same feather as Volodymyr Viatrovich, an unabashed apologist for the OUNB. And do note here the degree of revisionism, in addition to Viatrovich's sojourn in the U.S., look at the degree of revisionism that is taking place. Again, from Foreign Policy Magazine, May 2nd of 2016, The Historian Whitewashing Ukraine's Past by Josh Cohen. This is from Foreign Policy Magazine. Skipping down. Advocating a nationalist, revisionist history that glorifies the country's move to independence and purges bloody and opportunistic chapters, Volodymyr Vyatrovich has attempted to redraft the country's modern history to whitewash Ukrainian nationalist groups' involvement in the Holocaust and mass ethnic cleansing of Poles during World War II. And right now, he's winning. In May of 2015, Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko signed a law that mandated the transfer of the country's complete set of archives from the Soviet organs of repression, unquote, such as the KGB, and its decedent, the Security Service of Ukraine, or SBU, to a government organization called the Ukrainian Institute of National Memory. And I would add parenthetically, if that seems Orwellian in nature, that is just exactly what it is. It is standing Ukrainian history on its head. Skipping down. The controversy centers on a telling of World War II history that amplifies Soviet crimes and glorifies Ukrainian nationalist fighters while dismissing the vital part they played in ethnic cleansing of Poles and Jews from 1941 to 1945 after the Nazi invasion of the former Soviet Union. And more pointedly, scholars now fear that they risk reprisal for not towing the official line or calling Vyatrovich on his historical distortions. Under Vyatrovich's reign, the country could be headed for a new and frightening era of censorship. Skipping down. The revisionism focuses on two Ukrainian nationalist groups, the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, or OUN, and the Ukrainian Insurgent Army, or UPA, which fought to establish an independent Ukraine. During the war, these groups killed tens of thousands of Jews and carried out a brutal campaign of ethnic cleansing that killed as many as 100,000 Poles. Created in 1929 to free Ukraine from Soviet control, the OUN embraced the notion of an ethnically pure Ukrainian nation. When the Nazis invaded the Soviet Union in 1941, the OUN and its charismatic leader Stefan Bandera welcomed the invasion as a step toward Ukrainian independence. Its members carried out a pogrom in Lvov that killed 5,000 Jews, and OUN militias played a major role in violence against the Jewish population in western Ukraine that claimed the lives of up to 35,000 Jews. One of the things not mentioned here is that in the Lvov district, a street has been named in honor of the Einsatzgruppe Naftigal, or Naftigal Battalion, that was commanded by Roman Shukevich, now named a Hero of Ukraine by Viktor Yushchenko, and the father of Yuri Shukevich, who basically drafted the law criminalizing criticism of the OUN or UPA. And speaking of that law, the new law, which promises that people who, quote, publicly exhibit a disrespectful attitude toward these groups, meaning the UPA and the OUN, or, quote, deny the legitimacy of Ukraine's 20th century struggle for independence, will be prosecuted, though no punishment is specified, also means that independent Ukraine is being partially built on a falsified narrative of the Holocaust. I would add, on a falsified historical narrative, period. We're going to go into the deep political roots of Ukrainian fascism, both with Imperial Germany's General Staff, then with the Third Reich's military efforts, and finally, of course, as we have seen, it jumped to the CIA and the OPC, the Office of Policy Coordination, and the Republican Party, and was projected into a major role in contemporary Ukraine following its major role in the Cold War.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Returning to the foreign policy article, by transferring control of the nation's archives to Vyatrovich, Ukraine's nationalists assured themselves that management of the nation's historical memory is now in the, quote, correct, unquote, hands. In 2008, in addition to his role at the Institute for National Memory, Viktor Yushchenko, then president, appointed Beatrovich head of the Security Service of Ukraine's archives. Yushchenko made the promotion of OUN UPA political mythology a fundamental part of his legacy, rewriting school textbooks, renaming streets, and honoring OUN UPA leaders as, quote, heroes of Ukraine, unquote. As Yushchenko's leading memory manager both at TSDVR and the SBU, Viatrovich was his right-hand man in this crusade. Bear in mind that Yushchenko's first lady was a key OUNB/UCCA operative and the former deputy director of public liaison under Ronald Reagan, Ekaterina Chumachenko, who became Ekaterina Yushchenko. And bear in mind that his minister of justice was Yaroslav Stetsko's former secretary in the early 1980s, Roman Zvarich, representing a direct element of continuity between the OUNB of the World War II era and the present. Returning once again to Josh Cohen's text, as Yushchenko's leading memory manager both at the TSDVR and the SBU, Viatrovich was his right-hand man in this crusade. He continued to push the state-sponsored heroic representation of the OUN-UPA and their leaders Bandera, Yaroslav Stetsko, and Roman Shukevich. After Viktor Yanukovych was elected president in 2010, Viatrovich faded from view, skipping ahead. During this period, Viatrovich spent time in North America on a series of lecture tours, as well as a short sojourn as a research fellow at the Harvard Ukrainian Research Institute, or HURI. He also continued his academic activism, writing books and articles promoting the heroic narrative of the OUN and the UPA. In 2013, he tried to crash and disrupt a workshop on Ukrainian and Russian nationalism taking place at the Harriman Institute at Columbia. When the Maidan or Maidan Revolution swept Yanukovych out of power in February of 2014, Viatrovich returned to prominence. The new president, Poroshenko, appointed Viatrovich to head the Ukrainian Institute of National Memory, a prestigious appointment for a relatively young scholar. Skipping down. Viatrovich has dismissed historical events not comporting with this narrative, meaning the pro-OUN-UPA narrative, as Soviet propaganda. In his 2006 book, The OUN's Position Toward the Jews, Formulations of a Position Against the Backdrop of a Catastrophe, he attempted to exonerate the OUN from its collaboration in the Holocaust by ignoring the overwhelming mass of historical literature. The book was widely panned by Western historians. University of Alberta professor John Paul Himka, one of the leading scholars of Ukrainian history for three decades, described it as, quote, employing a series of dubious procedures, rejecting sources that compromise the OUN, accepting uncritically censored sources emanating from emigre OUN circles, failing to recognize anti-Semitism in OUN texts. Even more worrisome for the future integrity of Ukraine's archives under Viatrovich is his notoriety among Western historians for his willingness to allegedly ignore or even falsify historical documents. Scholars on his staff publish document collections that are falsified, unquote, said Jeffrey Birds, BURBS, a professor of Russian and Soviet history at Northeastern University. I know this because I have seen the originals, made copies, and have compared their transcriptions to the originals. 70 historians signed an open letter to Poroshenko asking him to veto the draft law that bans criticism of the OUN-UPA, skipping down. After that letter was published, the legislation's sponsor, Yuri Shukevich, reacted furiously. Shukevich, the son of UPA leader Roman Shukevich, and a longtime far-right political activist himself, fired off a letter to Minister of Education Sergei Kvit, K-V-I-T, claiming, quote, Russian special services, unquote, produced the letter and demanded that, quote, patriotic, unquote, historians rebuff it. Kvit, also a longtime far-right activist and author of an admiring biography of one of the key theoreticians of Ukrainian ethnic nationalism, in turn ominously highlighted the signatories of Ukrainian historians on his copy of that letter. And skipping down to give people an idea of the degree of historical revisionism taking place. Again, it is not just Holocaust denial, but a complete standing of Ukrainian World War II history on its head. UPA Supreme Commander Dmytro Klyashevsky explicitly stated, quote, We should carry out a large-scale liquidation action against Polish elements. During the evacuation of the German army, we should find an appropriate moment to liquidate the entire Polish male population between 16 and 60 years old, unquote. Given that over 70% of the leading UPA cadres possessed a background as Nazi collaborators, none of this is surprising. And again, of the Minister of Education, Sergei Kvit, K-V-I-T, last June, Kvit's Ministry of Education issued a directive to teachers regarding the, quote, necessity to accentuate the patriotism and morality of the activists of the liberation movement, including depicting the UPA as a, quote, symbol of patriotism and sacrificial spirit in the struggle for an independent Ukraine, unquote, and Bandera as, quote, an outstanding representative, unquote, of the Ukrainian people. More recently, Vyatrovich's Ukrainian Institute of National Memory proposed that the city of Kiev rename two streets after Bandera and the former supreme commander of both the UPA and the Nazi-supervised Schutzmannschaft, Roman Shukhevich. And again, they have already renamed a street in the Lvov district after the Einsatzgruppe Nachtigall that was commanded by Roman Shukhevich. So note the complete degree of revisionism. It is now criminal if you say anything critical about the UPA, and including, suppose you criticize this, Dmytro Klyashevsky's edict, to quote, we should find an appropriate moment to liquidate the entire Polish male population between 60 and 60 years old, 16 and 60 years old, unquote. If you were to say that in Ukraine, you would be guilty of a criminal offense. And note that the Minister of Education, Sergei Kvit, is a bird of the same feather. Note in particular that after Viktor Yushchenko and his, quote, Orange Revolution were voted out of office because they were incompetent and corrupt, Volodymyr Vyatrovich came back to the U.S. for a while. Then he went back after the Maidan Revolution. Bear in mind that the Maidan coup was funded in part by Pierre Omidyar of eBay, who also founded First Look Media and The Intercept, where Nazi collaborator Glenn Greenwald is currently holding forth. And Greenwald is just exactly that. What we're going to look at is the historical depth of the Ukrainian Fifth Column in the U.S. And again, I think the fact that Viktor Yushchenko had a former Reagan staffer as his wife, the fact that Roman Zvorich, who was Stetsko's secretary in the U.S., became Yushchenko's justice minister, the fact that Vyatrovich came back to the U.S. for a while, was working at Harvard University for a while, then came back to Ukraine after the Maidan or Maidan Revolution, is altogether significant. We're going to take a look now at the depth and development of the Ukrainian fascist Fifth Column in the U.S. and its collaboration with the Axis. And even before that, its collaboration with the Imperial German Intelligence Service and General Staff. We're going to begin by reviewing the Pilipenko affair. This from the Hitler Legacy by Peter Lavenda, copyright 2014. This fellow was a Ukrainian Orthodox priest and a Nazi spy. Alexei Pelepenko, P-E-L-Y-P-E-N-K-O, was ordained in 1915 and in the 1930s worked as a teacher in Munich during the time of the Third Reich. By 1937, he was in Argentina working for the local Gestapo chief, and by 1940 he was in Valparaiso, Chile, still working for the Nazis. As a Ukrainian, he was opposed to the occupation of his country by the Russians, and as a priest, he was opposed to communist atheism. When Ukrainians saw in Hitler a viable alternative to the regime in Moscow and were organizing themselves into a revolutionary force to support the Nazis at the time of their invasion of Russia. However, these same Ukrainians were disillusioned when the Hitler-Stalin Pact was signed, and it appeared that Russia and Germany would work together, thus robbing the Ukrainians of any hope of liberation. Hitler's invasion of the Soviet Union renewed the enthusiasm of some of the Ukrainians for Nazism, and an entire Waffen-SS division comprised of Ukrainian troops was formed, and eventually many of these resettled in the U.S. after the war. This historical episode has other ramifications, for it led to the formation of several important lobby groups that agitated for political and military resistance against the Soviet Union under the general rubric of captive nations organizations such as the World Anti-Communist League or WACL. The Pelepenko affair reveals the extent of the American Nazi network and the intention of its perpetrators to overthrow the U.S. government and install a military dictatorship that would remove Jewish and, quote, communist, unquote, influence at all levels of American life. Again, this last sentence. The Pelepenko affair reveals the extent of the American Nazi network and the intention of its perpetrators to overthrow the U.S. government and install a military dictatorship that would remove Jewish and, quote, communist, unquote, influence at all levels of American life. Pelepenko eventually decided that working for the Americans for a communist free bloc in Eastern Europe made more sense than waiting for Hitler to liberate his country. He contacted the FBI directly in 1940 and offered his support in infiltrating the Nazi networks that he knew existed in the U.S. What he had to tell the FBI was nothing short of astounding. What we're going to do is take a look at not only the depth and functioning of the Ukrainian fascist fifth column in the U.S., but its collaboration with the Third Reich and with fascist Japan, and also its long collaboration and genesis with the intelligence service and general staff of Weimar and Imperial Germany as well, because the Ostpolitik and the Drang nach Osten that German imperialists had long sought envisioned Ukraine as being part of a greater Germany, or at least a satellite of a greater Germany.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
What we're going to do is to rely on a text now called Sabotage, The Secret War Against America, co-authored by Michael Sayers and Albert E. Kahn. It was published in hardcover by Harper Brothers, 1942. By the way, Albert E. Kahn worked along with a number of other prominent Americans on an anti-fascist newsletter called The Hour. Among the other people who worked on that were sociologist Hannah Arendt, novelist Thomas Mann, and Albert Einstein. And again, in 1942, Albert E. Kahn and Michael Sayers published Sabotage, The Secret War Against America, and it talks about the genesis of the Ukrainian fifth column in this country and its collaboration with not only Nazi Germany, but pre-Nazi Germany and fascist Japan. This, to give an idea of the depth of this fifth column in the U.S. Bear in mind that at the end of World War II, many of the Ukrainian fascist elements that were just discussed in the passage from Peter Levenda's The Hitler Legacy that I read then were glommed onto this same milieu. In 1938, a sensational series of kidnappings occurred in New York City. A number of well-to-do persons were seized by a mysterious gang which blindfolded them, gagged them, and took them by car to a secret hideout in the city. Ransoms ranging from $100,000 to $200,000 were demanded. In certain cases, the kidnapped victims were tortured to make them write pleading notes to their relatives and friends. One of the victims, Norman Miller, who had been forced to pay $15,000 ransom. Bear in mind, this was in 1938, and that was a lot of money back then. Remember that while he had been held captive, he had heard church bells ringing, and the sound of billiard balls had been led, blindfolded, by his kidnappers. These clues helped the police to locate the Ukrainian National Home, a mutual benefit society at 217 through 219 East 6th Street in New York City, as the place that fitted Miller's description. On November 2, 1938, the police raided the Ukrainian National Home. In the basement, they found a torture chamber, its walls pitted with bullet holes. They also found a German-made machine gun and other weapons. The police dug up the basement floor and came upon human bones. One of the kidnapped men, Arthur Freed, F-R-I-E-D, of White Plains, had died under the torture. His body had been stuffed in a heating furnace and the bones later hidden under the basement floor. The four gangsters who made up the kidnapping gang were arrested. Two of them were sentenced to life imprisonment. The other two, Demetrius Gula, G-U-L-A, and Joseph Sakoda, S-A-C-O-D-A, were convicted of murder and executed in the electric chair at Sing Sing. One highly significant fact not mentioned at their trial was that Gula and Sokolov were both members of a Berlin-directed Ukrainian terrorist organization known as the ODWU. At the time, no one thought of connecting these brutal kidnappers with the Nazi espionage and sabotage machine in the U.S. Skipping down. The Berlin-directed ODWU again hovered just behind the headlines when, in early 1941, a Ukrainian-American captain in the U.S. Army was court-martialed and deprived of his commission for betraying confidential information to a foreign agent. This captain was the leader of an ODWU unit in Pennsylvania. The foreign agent in the case had been Omelin Senek Grabuski, G-R-I-B-I-W-I-S-K-Y, a Ukrainian terrorist who had come from Berlin in 1931 to found the ODWU in the U.S. Now, this is 1931. Another hint of the inner nature of the ODWU came on July 13, 1940, when the New York police arrested a Ukrainian-American named William Piznak, P-I-Z-N-A-K, on charges of violating the Sullivan Law. In the basement storeroom of Piznak's residence at 225 East 95th Street, detectives of the New York Sabotage Squad found a veritable arsenal, which included two machine guns, tear gas grenades, rifles, sets of brass knuckles, a trench knife, and 1,112 rifle cartridges of assorted calibers. William Piznak's brother, Michael Piznak, is an attorney for the Ukrainian Nationalist Association, an old Ukrainian-American society which the ODWU has sought to infiltrate and dominate. Until shortly before the police raid, the two Piznak brothers lived together in the house which contained the basement arsenal. The usually cautious attorney, Michael Piznak, revealed his own political proclivities at a Ukrainian meeting in Belvedere Park, New York, on July 1, 1938, when he declared, "Now Hitler calls the youth to organize. Now also Mussolini calls the youth to organize. And now we, the Ukrainian nationalists, too, must call the youth to organize." In August of 1940, the Hetman, H-E-T-M-A-N. Another Berlin-directed Ukrainian organization staged a public stormtroop demonstration in Chicago. The order of the day issued by the Chicago Hetman District Command, unquote, called upon the uniformed male youth hundreds, unquote, to appear armed with rifles, unquote. There are close to 1 million Ukrainian Americans in the U.S. The overwhelming majority of them are pro-democratic, but a Nazi-file minority made up the ODWU and the Hetman, two of the most dangerous espionage and sabotage organizations in the world. The Hetman operates under the supervision of Alfred Rosenberg's Außenpolitisches Amt, the foreign political office of the Nazi Party. The ODWU is more powerful than the Hetman and, if possible, more violent. Both organizations have built their cells in American industrial centers, and their agents work in munitions plants, mines, steel foundries, aircraft factories, shipyards, freight yards, and docks. A number of them have gained access to the U.S. Army. Both the ODWU and the Hetman are international organizations with branches throughout Europe, Asia, North, and South America. Their activities include spying, sabotage, spreading pro-Axis propaganda, and not infrequently, committing assassinations. The U.S. leaders of the ODWU and Hetman have been in regular communication with German, Japanese, and Italian agents, and with spies in South and Central America. In the spring of 1941, one of the confidential ODWU bulletins emanating from Berlin triumphantly described the sinking of several British ships sabotaged by ODWU members in Argentina and Brazil. It is remarkable that in all the literature dealing with the worldwide machinations of the Axis, practically no mention has been made of this most important auxiliary of the international Nazi espionage and sabotage machine, the fascist Ukrainian Fifth Column. Among Fifth Columns, it is unique in that the only land in which it cannot function is its native land. Its activities in the Ukraine were brought to an abrupt halt in 1938 when the Soviet authorities rounded up and executed its chief ringleaders there. In almost every other country in the world, and particularly in the U.S., this criminal and ruthless Fifth Column is still at work. Just how Hitler got hold of these terrorists among the Ukrainians and converted a section of them into the Ukrainian-American Fifth Column makes a story of international treachery and violence unparalleled in all the weird annals of the underworld of political crime. Skipping ahead. A familiar sight in Berlin in recent years was a little old man with a scrubby white beard who usually wandered about in oversized plus fours. The Nazis called him Professor of the Ukraine. His name was Dr. Paul Rohrbach, R-O-H as in Harry, R-B-A-C-H. Like his closest friend, the Nazi philosopher Dr. Alfred Rosenberg, Rohrbach was a Baltic German who contributed some important theories to the Nazi Party. Rohrbach was still a young scholar when he evolved the theory that the Ukrainians are a Germanic-type people and should therefore come under German rule. To win the support of the Ukrainians, then subjects of the Russian Tsar, the young Germanophile scholar wrote innumerable propaganda works urging the establishment of an independent Ukraine. Again, this is during the World War I period when the Tsar is still in power and the Kaiser is still in power in Germany.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. All of Dave Emery's 36 years of work is available for download on the SpitfireList.com website. The site includes many articles not included in the programs, as well as a small library of old anti-fascist books. All of the material on the website is available for free. Sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs. To subscribe to the podcast, use the link at the top of the description for this program or on the front page.
Resuming with that last sentence, to win the support of the Ukrainians, then subjects of the Russian Tsar, the young Germanophile scholar wrote innumerable propaganda works urging the establishment of an independent Ukraine, unquote. The idea appealed strongly to Kaiser Wilhelm, who had his imperial eye on Ukrainian wheat and oil. In 1918, after the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, by the way, that was a peace treaty between Germany and Russia, the Kaiser established an independent Ukraine, unquote, under German protection, unquote. Rohrbach was dispatched to Kiev to act as personal advisor to Field Marshal Hermann von Eichhorn, commander of the German forces in the Ukraine. A quisling Ukrainian government was set up, headed by a hitherto unrenowned Russian cavalryman named General Pavel Petrovich Skoropadsky. The general, who did not know one word of Ukrainian, received the title of the Hetman, headman of Ukraine, and the cabinet was formed around him, composed of various Russian and Ukrainian adventurers, chiefly distinguished for their murderous records as terrorists and anti-Semitic pogromists. But Rohrbach's triumph was short-lived. The newly formed Red Army, together with the forerunners of today's guerrilla bands, bear in mind that this was published in 1942, when World War II was very much underway. This newly formed Red Army, together with the forerunners of today's guerrilla bands, decimated the Kaiser's armies of occupation and drove them out of the Ukraine. Rohrbach hastily packed his books and returned to Berlin along with General Skoropadsky and his cutthroat cabinet. Field Marshal von Eichhorn, less fortunate, was buried in the Ukraine after he had been shot by a Ukrainian guerrilla. Back in Berlin, Rohrbach and his friends became the proteges of the German high command, which by the early 1920s was already plotting with the Nazi Party to overthrow the Weimar Republic and make a second bid for world conquest. Captain Franz von Papen joined the glowing circle of Rohrbach's admirers, and the concept of an independent Ukraine, unquote, appealed as strongly to Adolf Hitler as it had formerly done to the Kaiser. The Hetman organization was placed under the personal supervision of Dr. Alfred Rosenberg, the chief Nazi advocate of eastward expansion. General Skoropadsky, who could still barely stutter in Ukrainian, retained his title as the Hetman of Ukraine and leader of the Hetman organization. Skipping down. At this point, Colonel Walter Nikolai, head of the intelligence service of the High Command of Germany, took a hand in the Ukrainian game. For various reasons, Nikolai felt that General Skoropadsky was not the man to head the Ukrainian Fifth Column. While Nikolai did not interfere in any way with Alfred's organization of the Hetman apparatus, he went to organize an international Ukrainian apparatus of his own. From the start, Nikolai had his eye on the large Ukrainian community in the U.S. The man chosen by Nikolai to head this international Fifth Column, again with a major element in the U.S., was Colonel Konovalets, K-O-N-O-V-A-L-E-T-Z, who had served with the Kaiser's armies of occupation in the Ukraine. Konovalets was a tall, blondish man with gray, watery eyes, a military bearing, and a passion for jewels. He had earned himself considerable notoriety in Ukraine as a rapist and a killer. When he left with the Germans in 1919, he brought out with him two large trunks loaded with looted gold, silver, and jewels. Hitler met him in 1922 and took an immediate liking to him. Again, these are events taking place in the early 1920s. By 1930, Konovalets was known to the intelligence bureaus of the world's powers as one of Germany's leading espionage agents. He was also working for the Japanese General Staff. His various missions took him to every corner of the European continent, to Asia, and from both North and South America. Wherever there were Ukrainian communities in Soviet Russia, France, Romania, Czechoslovakia, Poland, South America, Canada, and the U.S., Colonel Konovalets's emissaries traveled at the expense of the German government and established OUN cells. Special schools for OUN members were opened in Germany, where the students were carefully trained in the arts of espionage, sabotage, and assassination. The first of these schools was founded by the German War Office in Danzig around 1928. German intelligence officers acted as instructors. The OUN students, again, the OUN was set up under the supervision of the Intelligence Department of the German War Office, jumping back here by way of review. The International Organization of Spies and Saboteurs, which Knoevelets set up under the supervision of the Intelligence Department of the German War Office, went by the name of Ukrainska Organizacja Nacionalistov, the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, commonly referred to as the OUN. The group now in power, dominating Ukrainian politics, is the OUNB, and criticizing either the OUN or the UPA is now criminal in Ukraine. Remember, this was formed in 29 under the auspices of the intelligence services of what was then Weimar Germany. Skipping down again. The OUN students were taught the various methods of stealing military secrets, making bombs, blowing up factories, and carrying out political murders. Courses in regular German army training were also part of the curriculum. OUN graduates from this Danzig school destroyed scores of factories and farms by sabotage, fires, and explosions in Poland during the years 1928 through 31. They also assassinated a number of prominent Polish politicians before the Polish authorities finally arrested several OUN terrorists and imprisoned or executed them. The remaining OUN members were temporarily withdrawn from Poland and were put to work with other of Knoevelets' followers in the Nazi Party in Germany. When Hitler came to power, a central academy for the OUN was founded in Berlin. The Nazis spared no expense in building this academy and supplying it with expert instructors and scientific equipment. The academy's address is 75 Mecklenburgische Straße, Berlin. Its title is School for Espionage, Sabotage, and Terrorism. Skipping down. The OUN later sent Knoevelets' successor, Ormelian Senek Grabowski, on special errands of murder, sabotage, or intrigue as far afield as Canada, South Africa, South America, Italy, and Japan. His compatriots gave him a nickname which, freely translated, means Salesman of Terror. This was the man who arrived in the U.S. in 1931, again 2 years before Hitler came to power, to organize the ODWU, the Organization for the Rebirth of the Ukraine, which was to serve as the American counterpart of Berlin's OUN. 2 years later, with the Nazis in power and unlimited funds at his disposal, the Salesman of Terror returned to the U.S. to develop the ODWU and spread its sinister branches across the 48 states. With German money, Senek Grabowski financed scores of EDWU front organizations or ODWU front organizations, which mushroomed under his expert guidance in the industrial cities where Ukrainian Americans lived. Skipping down again. On the last evening he spent in the U.S. before leaving for Germany again, Senek Grabowski visited an office at 83 Grand Street, Jersey City, New Jersey. He went there to pick up confidential mail, which he was to carry to Europe, and to leave final orders for ODWU work in the U.S. 83 Grand Street, Jersey City, is the headquarters of the powerful Ukrainian nationalist organization and of its official publication, Svoboda, S-V-O-B-O-D-A, which is edited by Luka Myshuha, M-I-S-H-U-H-A, otherwise known as the Big Mouse. In 1933, when the Nazis took over in Germany and started their organization of the ODWU in America, Myshuha became the editor of Svoboda. Skipping down again. With Myshuha at its head, Svoboda was converted into an organ of Axis propaganda and a medium for conveying instructions to ODWU spies. The Svoboda offices at 83 Grand Street, Jersey City, became a clearinghouse for espionage directives coming in from Berlin, Tokyo, and Rome. For many years, these directives have been regularly reaching the Svoboda offices by mail from Spanish and South American drops, or through the special couriers, unquote, of the Axis spy systems. Liaison officers from Germany and Japan made their headquarters at 83 Grand Street when they visited the U.S. Senek Grabowski's mail was always sent to the address of Svoboda. Here, certain Axis agents paid their last calls before sailing for Europe, and from here they were accompanied to the pier, where the last confidential words were exchanged and remained as sealed secrets until couriers, unquote, arrived with further orders. Again, note that Svoboda was the title of the official OUN publication in the U.S. It was headquartered in Jersey City and was basically under the supervision of the German General Staff, even before, basically, after the Nazis took over. Note that the Ukrainian Fifth Column, fundamentally fascist in nature, was active in the U.S. even before Hitler came to power, and its activities were conducted in conjunction with the German General Staff. Svoboda, by the way, means freedom in a number of Eastern European languages. I don't think it is coincidental at all that the Nazi Svoboda Party in Ukraine has the same name as the Svoboda paper of the OUN/OVWU in the U.S. And again, there was much celebration in the Western press when Arseniy Yatsenyuk, the extremely corrupt prime minister of Ukraine, was replaced by an aide to a close chum of Petro Poroshenko, who was nominally Jewish, but that new prime minister had a apparently bogus law degree from a MUP, spelled MAUP University in Ukraine, the largest private university in that country and an epicenter of anti-Semitic propaganda. One of MOP's faculty members was David Duke. Again, that will be in the printed description for this show. Note who became the Speaker of the Parliament, however. Rada appoints Andrei Paraguay as Speaker. This from the Agence France-Presse, published in the Kiev Post of April 14th of 2016. The Ukrainian Verkhovna Rada has relieved Andrei Paraguay of his duties as first parliamentary chairman and appointed him as its chairman. He is a key member of the Nazi Svoboda Party, now the Speaker of the Ukrainian Parliament. There has been a lot of tension in the city of Odessa and the district of Odessa in Ukraine as the second anniversary of the burning alive of anti-government protesters by Ukrainian fascist elements was approaching. The Guardian has an article by Sean Walker in its issue of May 2nd of 2016. Tensions run high in Odessa on anniversary of deadly clashes. It talks about how Ukrainian nationalists, unquote, read fascists, have celebrated those burnings. Note who Mikhail Saakashvili, the now disgraced former president of Georgia who cannot return to Georgia because he has been indicted for a number of felonies. Note whom he appointed to keep order in Odessa. In the run-up to the second anniversary of the attacks, Saakashvili had pleaded with Kiev to send reinforcements into the city, fearing provocations, unquote, from Russia or local separatist groups. About 300 members of Azov, formerly a volunteer battalion with many far-right members and now part of the official National Guard, were dispatched to Odessa. In many shows, and it will be in this one, we have pictures from a Norwegian TV documentary that was shown on German television of the helmets worn by the Azov battalion. They feature the swastika and the SS rune. They are now being trained in part by the Pentagon. And again, the article about the MOP background of the current Prime Minister of Ukraine will be in the printed description for this show. However, we are all out of time. This concludes For the Record program number 907, Update on Ukraine, being recorded on May 15th of the year 2016. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.